Our next case this morning is Zenith Electronics against WHTV Broadcasting. Wait till the exchange has been completed here. Rustling has died down. Trust it was nothing about you, Mr. Starkman, that caused large numbers to flee the courtroom.
I certainly hope not, Your Honor.
Mr. Starkman.
Judge Easterbrook, Your Honors, may it please the court. WHTV was a company created in 1987 and became a profitable TV services provider. It operates in Puerto Rico through a multi-channel, multi-point distribution system. That's a tower system that's unique to underwired parts of the world, including islands and third world countries. In the late 1990s, the company correctly anticipated the digital revolution and went about taking steps to convert its system to digital. They solicited proposals for set-top boxes that were DVB compliant, in other words, could decode and translate pictures in accordance with international standards, and had other required features. Zenith responded to the request for proposal with representations that they could provide the kinds of equipment that WHTV wanted, and ultimately, agreement was reached to acquire up to 37,000 STBs to serve the market.
When their stuff proved to be totally as bad as you indicate, and I think at least Motorola concedes that Zenith was giving you a bunch of junk, why didn't you seek to have it returned to them or try to sue them with regard to that?
Well, ultimately, the promises that kept that were forthcoming.
So they strung you along, promises they'd fix it.
Strung WHTV along. There were 8 separate attempts at modifying the software. By the time the division that made these boxes was sold to Motorola, and Motorola immediately stepped up to the plate and said, "Don't worry, we'll fix it." So,
wink, wink, nod, nod.
So the question.
Isn't that right? That's what they said in their internal memo, wasn't it?
That's exactly what they said. And ultimately made the representations directly at a meeting in Philadelphia in November of 2000, and they tried to make the repairs. So what we have here is a viable case for breach of contract and fraud against Zenith and a viable case for promissory estoppel against Motorola. The problem that Judge Lindberg found was that damages for the franchise value that was lost through the defective boxes were not provable because the expert testimony in this case of Dr. Peter Shapiro was not tested against a somewhat comparable market. Dr. Shapiro is a leading expert in cable and telecommunications valuation. His credentials were never questioned in this case. He not only does the seminar teaching and lecturing and writing that other experts do, but he actually uses the models he creates in establishing valuations for various cable and telecommunications companies.
Has he testified before?
He has never testified at a trial. He has testified at a couple of recent depositions. He has testified before Congress. The ultimate conclusion that he reached is of this potential market of 600,000, DirecTV, WHTV's main competitor, who's in the satellite business, would get about 215,000 subscribers, and WHTV would get 10% of that. He did it by analyzing 5 crucial competitive factors that we believe, demonstrate factually the soundness, the reasonability, the responsibility of his conclusion. Judge Lindbergh said that's not good enough. You have to test the conclusion against a different market. The problem here is Puerto Rico is unique in many different respects.
I must say, counsel, I don't understand that. There are established statistical tools for assessing the effect of differences, and the multivariate regression is the most obvious of them, where you put in variables about income, average penetration, and so on, and then find out what the effect of those independent variables on the dependent variable is. It sounded like your proposed expert didn't know any of the standard statistical tools for dealing with this kind of variance.
That kind of analysis would have, Your Honor, implicated the same, if not a greater level of judgment than Judge Lindbergh found wanting in this case.
But was there a place where this witness explained why he didn't use a regression?
There's not.
So it's... And if he had said, I considered a regression, and here are the reasons why I thought it inappropriate here, that I could understand. But you're not the expert, and so you're not the right person to tell us why a regression wasn't used.
But no one suggested that a regression be used below. No one challenged the method by which he proceeded.
What were the specific objections to his testifying?
The objection was that the expert conclusions were ipsy-dixit because they were not tested against another market. The case we cite in our brief, City of Tuscaloosa, is, we think, instructive because there the court says in a market comparison situation, testing is not even a relevant consideration under Daubert because all of the markets are different and because there is no repetitive analysis possible.
And that's what I don't understand. That's what regressions are for, is for taking out differences. Right? It's just the tool designed for this problem. And to identify the problem without explaining why you don't use the standard tool for dealing with that problem doesn't seem a good reason for then just doing something else. It seems to identify somebody who's not familiar with the standard statistical methods of addressing this difficulty.
Well, even in those circumstances, in a standard discounted cash flow analysis, a level of judgment is going to...
The regression, by the way, is completely different from a discounted cash flow analysis. They have nothing in common.
I understand, but the discounted cash flow employed by this expert involved a utilization of factors that conceivably could have otherwise been established by regressions to take out the various differences. But in this case, the level of intellectual rigor simply wasn't challenged. In fact, it was accepted by Zena's expert. And the exercise of professional judgment is not something that precludes the expert from testifying. The reasonableness of the conclusion, whether the conclusion can flow from the facts, whether the conclusion is counterfactual, are all considerations that apply, and in this case, none of them do. We think that Judge Zagel's decision in the remand proceedings in the Thai case that we cited as a supplemental authority to our brief is directly on point. In that case, the expert was allowed to testify based on his 30 years of experience in the publishing industry, which percentage of damages flow from pictures and which from text. And we think this case is very consistent with that. And we think that Judge Lindbergh's elevation of testing above all of the other reliability criteria of Daubert creates an impermissible barrier on otherwise viable and correct expert testimony. These conclusions that Dr. Shapiro reached were clearly subject to cross-examination, and the test he used to get there is not and should not be the controlling factor. Judge Lindbergh also kept out any other evidence of damages, and he did so for two particular reasons. One is has to do with an interrogatory answer. The second has to do with his views on Rule 701 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. Ideally, we believe that Dr. Shapiro's testimony and his expert opinion should be admitted on remand, and therefore these issues are not as significant. But the interrogatory answer upon which he kept out the other evidence of damages has to do with an incorporation of documents. In the initial response to, under Rule 26A, the initial disclosures, there is a lengthy recitation of damages based on projections given to various financial institutions. Subsequently, there's an interrogatory specifically asking for damages, and that was answered by a response saying, look at the following documents. Ultimately, Judge Lindbergh ruled that evidence of damages is not...
Let me ask you, the projections were for securing financing?
Yes. And Judge Lindbergh said that he was excluding them simply because the WHDV did not incorporate its initial disclosures into its interrogatory answer, and we think that kind of ruling is a bit harsh under the circumstances when the people who prepared the projections, company employees, were deposed and damages were generally known. The way these damages would ultimately get in evidence under WHDV's theory, and assuming Dr. Shapiro's testimony were not allowed, is through internal company employees. The controller of WHDV, acting with others, speaking to customers, speaking to others in the digital business, speaking to bankers, compiled an internal projection which were used at several financing sources. He concluded that the conversion to digital would ultimately reach about 23,000 additional homes, combined with the 7,000 subscribers that they had at the time, and that would get them up to about 30,000. The district court held as a matter of law, really, without having a hearing or looking into the specifics of the fact, that that's not permitted under Rule 701 of the Rules of Evidence. We think that's wrong. The advisory committee notes specifically identify that projected profits are admissible if a company witness testifies within his particularized knowledge. People who make representations to banks are at least in the same capacity testimonially of those who make declarations against interest. So there's simply no allegation that, and no factual finding, that the WHDV business representatives didn't have the scope of knowledge necessary to testify to the projections. So either under the exclusion of Dr. Shapiro's opinion or the exclusion of the WHTV witnesses, we think Judge Lindbergh incorrectly precluded proof of damages. If this case is to go back, the key issue, as far as we're concerned, is the limitation in the sales orders. There were four separate 2000 STB orders. Zenith claims that they sent a sales order with each one of them. The back of the sales order in small type contains a limitation to repair replacement. WHTV says we didn't get the first three, and as to the fourth one, it came late in the day after payments were made and after we started to complain about the defects. On cross motions for summary judgment, Judge Lindberg held that the first one wasn't sent, the first sales order. The second two and three, created a factual question. And number four was admitted being sent. He also held that the limitation on damages contained in the sales order was not a modification of the contract. In a reply brief, as the pleadings evolve, WHTV raised the issue that even if it wasn't a contract modification, it is on its face a failure of remedy. And in lieu of the evolution of the negotiations, unconscionable. Judge Lindberg refused to consider that issue because it was not raised until a reply brief. To send this case to a jury with instructions saying, if you find that number one was sent, find damages in one way, and if you find it wasn't sent, find them in another way, and then to do it again for our sales orders two and three, it just would create massive confusion. So we think in failing to consider an issue that would have taken that matter away from the jury and could have been resolved as a matter of law, namely, this remedy limitation fails of its essential purpose.
I'm not sure why these provisions in the invoices would matter much given the doctrine of Hadley against Baxendale. Now, I notice that Hadley is cited, not relied on that heavily, but at least adverted to in Zenith's brief, and that you have not. Isn't this just the core territory of the Hadley doctrine?
Well, we think that first of all, there are sufficient facts to get to the jury on the question of foreseeability. We were talking in terms of 30 to 37,000 set-top boxes. We had established a schedule of release over the course of time. There was enough information for Zenith to know that the period in which we needed to roll them out was critical. So we don't think that foreseeability is a issue as a matter of law that can be resolved, at least on this record at this point.
Counsel, could you tell me just very briefly, what's the technology and what you're using? How do your customers receive their signal? Is that a satellite arrangement or what?
It's a tower transmission through a head end off a tower into the customer's.
Like a radio SPD. Transmission?
Somewhat.
Okay, that's good enough.
Finally, one word about Motorola. This case was not abandoned against Motorola. They were part of the final judgment order in this case. The judge ruled that no damages existed against Motorola solely because he kept out Dr. Shapiro's testimony. There was no need for the court, and the court didn't address whether Dr. Shapiro's third report dealing exclusively with Motorola was admissible or not. They were served with a notice of appeal. They had enough information in the briefs to file a 38-page reply. This case wasn't abandoned against Motorola. It's not based on the asset purchase agreement between Zenith and Motorola. It's based directly on Motorola's representations to WHTV representatives that they could fix the boxes, and in fact they couldn't and walked away, and we think the case should be remanded against Motorola on the promissory estoppel issue as well. So for these reasons, we think the case should be reversed and remanded with instructions to admit the expert testimony and the sales limitation invalidated. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Starkman. Mr. Benjamin.
May it please the Court, Lawrence Benjamin on behalf of Zenith Electronics. Your Honor, may I address first your question on the technology? Basically, WHTV has like a satellite.
Could you raise your voice a bit to make sure we both get you on the recording and you're audible throughout?
Yes, I will, Your Honor. I just want to contrast the technology that WHTV had with DirecTV's technology. What WHTV had was a transmitting tower, and the inputs into their transmitting tower were from a variety of sources. They could get some fat satellite feed down from
It would probably help us if you would face us rather than facing the side or backwards.
A satellite farm. They could also sort of in-house have some kind of studio broadcasting or put their own. You could have local. So there could be various inputs into their transmitting tower, and then from their transmitting tower, they had a 35-mile radius. So the signal would be, if this was the surface of the ground, it would be from the height of the tower signal. The difference between them and DirecTV would be DirecTV would be from the sky, so the azimuth would be greater, like this instead of like this, which meant they would have not likely to be as blocked by foliage or billboards or things like that.
And their primary customer base was non-cable.
That's correct. Because up until the digital, they had a analog offering with a modest channel offering, like 24 channels, and the point of the conversion was to increase the number of channels that they could offer. Judge Easterbrook asked about the standards that this expert employed and whether he was familiar with basic standards. That expert was not able to demonstrate to the district judge any methodology for reaching
his conclusion. Did anybody ask him why he didn't use a multivariate regression or some other well-understood statistical method of dealing with differences across cities and markets?
I don't believe so, Judge. He was asked about his discounted cash flow model and the inputs. What method did he use to reach those inputs? And the most illustrative example of this, Your Honors, is when he later on did a supplement to his report to calculate the portion of damage that he attributed to post-August 2000. So he assumed everything was the same, except that WHTV, instead of launching in September 1999, it would launch in August 2000. Everything else is the same, but simply by virtue of that fact, the launch was delayed for a year. He said the market shares, instead of being 10, 20, 30, and 10, that kind of curve that he has, instead of that, he halved it. He cut it in half, 5, 10, 15, 5. And he was asked, why did you do that? What is the basis for that? Is there any objective methodology? He said, it's based on my CV. It's based on my curriculum vitae. And that curriculum vitae primarily consisted of consulting for Arthur Young, and he had never done evaluation himself. I think he said he co-authored one. He was on one else. But for this case, he had to turn to somebody else to help instruct and tutor him on basic valuation methodology.
Why couldn't all these supposed flaws in his opinion be explored on cross-examination? Why didn't this go just to the weight to be given to his testimony and not to its admissibility?
It was explored on cross-examination, Your Honor.
But in front of a jury.
The judge?
I think this is a fairly close Daubert question. And if it is, and this is sort of a unique situation to come up with what the damages are here. If Zenith really did provide all these boxes and they were defective, and it seems sort of strange that there's no remedy, and maybe his analysis isn't perfect. but you can explore those imperfections on cross-examination in front of a jury.
There's a few questions in your question, Your Honor, and the first one is, the first answer, I think, is why didn't he let it go to the jury and do it in front of the jury? The Supreme Court says not only the judge's conclusion, but the way he arrives at it is also reviewed for abuse of discretion. Judge Lindbergh doesn't wait to trial to do everything. Some judges are like that. Throw everything and we'll deal with it at trial. That's not how Judge Lindbergh manages his courtroom. He has discretion to do that.
And I know, and Daubert recognizes that there's a real gatekeeping responsibility on the part of the trial judge to keep out this kind of junk science sort of stuff, but I don't know if this case, if it seems like it's that close to that issue.
More than that, more than just deferring to his discretion, Judge, these appellants, the WHTV, never told Judge Lindbergh what other evidence or what else they would do at trial. What more would they do at trial? What is it that they would demonstrate or say at trial? And even on appeal, they don't tell you what more they could have or would have done at trial.
Well, what about, let's say that Zenith sends these boxes, TV, this little company outside San Juan, sends these boxes to its customers, saying we got great digital service now, and doesn't work. What's the remedy for that?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, question, they claim that they wanted to get first into this digital market, convert from their analog to digital, and they went to you and you said, yep, we can give you the boxes that'll do that, and it didn't work.
Yes. Judge, the answer is it's axiomatic that for a cause of action, breach of contracts, there's three elements: breach, causation, damages. It's not enough to just prove breach and walk in and say I'm entitled to there must be a remedy.
Do you agree there's breach?
We have not appealed from the breach is not as yes, but the breach is not as egregious as has been portrayed in the record, and just the count.
See, everybody would agree that they breached a contract if all they'd be stuck with is nominal damages, as you were here.
Your Honor, if a person runs through a red light and there's no car coming through the other way, he might get a nominal traffic ticket, but he's not going to get sued for hitting a pedestrian. Even if he crosses that red light and another red car comes the other way and they both run the red light and there's a dead pedestrian on the road, but the other car hit it and not him, there's no causation. You need all three elements. And in the business world, it happens all the time that contracts are not followed, but there is no consequence because it doesn't matter. And in this case, they were unable to prove by any admissible evidence that they were damaged. Not only that, Your Honors, but on the causation issue, which is related, the reason Judge Lindbergh didn't let them promote their alternative damage theory, which you have to appreciate, is it would have been a complete sandbag to us. There were three experts here, not just one. There were three experts, all with wildly different methodologies. One of them took another expert's opinion and took 1 year of income and multiplied it and then did some kind of averaging. Another one assumed that the loss, business loss, was only temporary, not permanent. It was only after all three experts were barred, then WHTV wanted to say, well, we've got a new theory. And these projections that they rely on, these March projections, they had been superseded by November 1998 projections, where now it was 15,000. They then had an expert who talked about 60,000 by year three. There were literally five different management projections. And as to the testimony that they cite, that they say I cited their controller, the actual testimony that they cite actually goes to a 1994 projection, in which when I asked him the basis of, you know, taking 8% of some number, he said, I don't know. In terms of, Judge Lindbergh didn't insist that it be tested against other markets. He said, let me look at this to see what else you've got. You didn't test. Let me see what else you've got to satisfy the Daubert criteria. And all he could see was they made a complete leap from these five factors that they identify to their conclusion. and it was within his discretion to say that leap is too big, that's speculative. And then when they delayed it for, when they assumed, just changed an assumption that the start would be delayed for a year, they cut those market shares in half on nothing but his CV.